This is the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Good to have you with us this hour. We'll hear from author Erica Armstrong Dunbar. She's written a new biography of abolitionist and Underground Railroad conductor Harriet Tubman. Also, Election Day is tomorrow, and in Philadelphia, third-party candidates for city council are making their presence known in a big way. We'll have that story and more. But to begin, when Pennsylvanians get to the voting booth, they'll consider a referendum which asks that the rights of crime victims be enshrined in the state constitution, the so-called Marcy's Law Amendment. However, even as votes are cast and counted, they might not be certified. The referendum is being appealed in court, and Commonwealth Court Judge Ellen Seisler has ruled that certification won't happen, if it does at all, until the legal process has run its course. Acting Secretary of State Kathy Brookvar is trying to get the injunction thrown out. Will votes on the Marcy's Law referendum eventually be tossed aside? Here to help us take a deeper dive into the story is Katie Meyer, Harrisburg Bureau Chief and reporter for WHYY. Hi, Katie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. So if I have this right, the state Supreme Court might have some answers for us today, at least as far as the injunction is concerned.
Yeah, that's right. We're really going down to the wire on this one. So we have that injunction already in place, the preliminary injunction from the Commonwealth Court. Now, the only way that can be overturned is if the Supreme Court rules on it, overturns it. And that's what the Attorney General's office and the Department of State is asking them to do. So we are expecting, and of course, you can never know for sure with the court system. They don't really telegraph their moves too far in advance usually, but we are expecting a ruling on that today. So they will either uphold that injunction from the lower court, or they will overturn it, which means we'll have two reversals on this in just, a few days, which, for a constitutional amendment, that's a lot of action really late in the game.
I'll say. But to be clear, Katie, the question will be on the ballot, so constituents should vote regardless.
Yes, absolutely. So all of the ballots are going to look exactly the same as they would injunction or no. And all of the counties are going to be carrying out their election processes exactly as they would be normally, which means we're going to have, even if the injunction stands, we'll get a good sense of whether or not Marcy's Law even passes. So, and we'll be watching that tomorrow, either way. So, everyone should vote as normal. If, the injunction is sustained and eventually the amendment is found unconstitutional, then the vote will never be certified by the Department of State. But if the injunction does not stand, if the amendment is eventually found constitutional, those votes will be essentially unfrozen, and people's votes will be counted just like they normally would be.
Briefly, tell us about Marcy Lee Nicholas and her story.
Sure. So Marcy Nicholas, she was murdered by an ex-boyfriend in the 80s. And shortly after this had happened, the person who killed her, it was known, he was charged, and then he was out of jail on bail, I believe, and her family saw him in a supermarket, and it was traumatic for them. And so in the subsequent years, her brother has been essentially bankrolling this effort to give victims certain rights in state constitutions. So it happened first in California. It didn't happen until 2008 that they passed that amendment, but Marcy's home state of California was the first state to pass these laws or these amendments. And essentially what it does and what it was initially intended to do is offer victims notification in case, the person who's accused in the crime that affected them is out of jail on bail, or if they've gotten free, or if they've escaped. And it's also been sort of bulked out in subsequent years to include things like making a victim impact statement at trial. Pennsylvania's version includes certain rights like being able to refuse discovery requests from the accused or someone acting on their behalf. So it all sort of sprang from that incident.
So in Pennsylvania, there are already victims' rights laws on the books. How does having these laws enshrined in the Constitution help victims?
Sure. So I'll kind of give you what the Marcy's Law supporters say about this. So we do have a pretty robust, set of victims' rights in the state constitution, and that's in statute, not in the Constitution. So these are just regular laws. And so they allow victims and give victims the right to notification. They give them the right to make an impact statement, things like that. The people who support Marcy's Law say, they're not party to a case under these laws. So if a victim for instance, feels like their rights have been ignored. Say they weren't given a chance to make an impact statement at trial. There's not a ton that they can do because they're not a party to the case to say, actually, I think this didn't go the correct way. So under Marcy's law, they would have standing. They couldn't, you know, counter sue or anything, but they could say, I would like this part of the process to be redone because I don't think I was heard. And so that's really what the Marcy's Law supporters say is the important change here.
Opponents are concerned that the rights of the accused might be compromised. Where are they coming from here?
So they're coming from all sorts of places. They have a lot of different concerns. And if anybody's very interested, I would recommend you read the Commonwealth Court ruling on this or read the story that I did on it because, you know, the concerns are wide-ranging and there's lots of them. But essentially, there are a few things that are included in Marcy's Law, like, as I mentioned a minute ago, the right to refuse discovery. Now, under Pennsylvania law, you know, discovery is never really done by the accused person themselves. You know, they wouldn't have direct contact with the, you know, the supposed victim, and their lawyer wouldn't really either. Generally, this is done through a court. So they would ask the judge, you know, say they want text messages. They don't know what the victim's, you know, cell phone provider is, but they want text messages to try to make their case stronger. If the judge finds that that's material to the case, they will, you know, issue an order and, you know, order the victim to turn over those text messages. And so the concern about Marcy's Law is really a question of how judges will use this law and how they will enforce it because, you know, we've seen many times in Pennsylvania and in other states, different judges make different decisions based on the same laws and the same constitutional provisions. So they're concerned that a judge would say, well, this victim now has a constitutional right not to turn over information that they don't want to, a right to refuse discovery. And they're concerned the judge would then turn around and say, I can't overrule their constitutional right if they don't want to give it. And then the accused person, you know, would have much more trouble building their case if they can't get certain information. The Marcy's Law people, the people who support it, say it wouldn't happen that way. But, you know, the American Civil Liberties Union, the League of Women Voters, the people, you know, the defense attorneys who don't like this law say, we don't know how it would be used. We don't know, you know, what it's going to do, and we can't risk that.
A lot of unknowns.
Katie
Meyer, the state, as we mentioned earlier, is supporting victims' advocates. What are the state's concerns?
Well, the state's concerns, as far as Marcy's Law goes.
Voter turnout, for instance. They're concerned about the injunction.
Exactly, yes. So the injunction, you know, it did happen really late in the game. And so they, in court, you know, the attorneys who were arguing on behalf of the state and in support of Marcy's Law said that, you know, the ACLU, the groups who brought this suit, they, you know, had the language. It was certified earlier in October, so they could have brought the suit a few weeks earlier. They're saying that, you know, the language has been out there. You know, maybe it should have been challenged in a way that wasn't in court at the last minute, because what they're concerned about is that people will get confused and then not vote or vote, you know, a different way than they would have already. So really their question is whether or not this undermines the election. They say it does. The ACLU, of course, turns around and says, well, you know, and this is the basis, the fundamental basis of the preliminary injunction that they filed for and received so far. They say, well, Marcy's Law is too broad. It does too many things to the Constitution, and it should be asked in multiple questions, not just in one. They think that the ballot question that voters are going to read and vote based upon is too broad, too vague, maybe biased. And so they're saying, no, it actually undermines the vote in its current state. So we have two very different views of what undermines the vote here.
The ACLU filed suit on October 10th. That's less than a month before the election, but apparently, under the state rules, not too close.
No rule on that. You know, it's totally legal what they did.
Yeah. Judge Seisler apparently found enough weight to the ACLU's argument to hold. Try to put a hold on the certification process. Is it accurate to say, Katie, that Seisler seems to be leaning toward the plaintiff side?
I mean, I think absolutely. And you could kind of tell a little bit during the actual hearing earlier in October, but I think she was very clear in her ruling. She thought, and she acknowledged also that this is kind of an unprecedented decision that she has made, but she says that Marcy's Law itself is sort of unprecedented, and I'm just quoting right from her decision here, her order. She said that an exhaustive search of Pennsylvania case law reveals no other amendment to a section of the Constitution that was as sweeping as in scope as Marcy's Law. So she came down on it in a way that, you know, Marcy's Law is this big amendment that does a lot to the Constitution in lots of different places, and she didn't think it should be one amendment. So she was pretty clear.
And again, we have not seen, at least in your time as a reporter in Harrisburg, a decision such as the one that was made by Judge Seisler.
No, and she actually, and she said this herself in the ruling, and, you know, I've only been in Harrisburg for 3 years, but she looked back much further. She said that something like this, as far as she could tell, has never occurred.
So let's talk about the referendum itself. It was approved by the legislature. Was it an overwhelming vote? Was it so-so? I mean, how did that go?
Yeah, so it was a very overwhelming vote. The governor always sort of supported this thing, even though he doesn't, you know, actually weigh in on it in an official way. I looked back at just the most recent vote that was done this session on Marcy's Law. The entire Senate voted in favor of it, so very bipartisan. Only, I think, six or so members of the House voted against it, and that was mostly sort of progressive Democrats who had expressed concerns along the same lines as the ACLU. So this was not controversial when it came to the legislature, and in fact, they never really held any. They never held any public hearings on it. It was sort of a. It felt a little bit like a done deal the whole time.
And you know, the legislature is Republican majority, but Democratic Governor Wolf seems to be behind this.
Yeah, again, it's really. It doesn't seem like a partisan issue to me. And Wolf has always been supportive. Obviously, his Department of State is very actively defending this.
Let's take a look at what's happened with Marcy's Law across the country. You alluded to the fact that it had been adopted in some other states. How many?
Yeah, so it was adopted over the years in 12 different states, but then it was overturned in two states. So it's been, I mean, lots of other states, I think New Hampshire maybe decided not to pass it. Their legislature struck it down. But it's been, you know, picking up steam. Again, so California passed it in 2008, and other states have been sort of following suit slowly but surely ever since.
If Marcy's Law is eventually adopted as an amendment to the state constitution in Pennsylvania, is this the end of the story? Does the ACLU and other parties which oppose it have room to sue?
They certainly do, and I think they certainly would plan to. So, again, it's unclear what they're going to do at this point, but or what's going to happen. You know, we have one day until the election, and things could change dramatically if the injunction is overturned. But say it is overturned, hypothetically, and Marcy's Law becomes part of the Constitution after this election. The ACLU has communicated to me and to other reporters that they absolutely intend to continue this legal challenge. Their legal challenge right now is based on the broadness of the law and how it is passing. The challenge, I think, if they brought a different suit, would be to, you know, the substance of it, you know, what it actually does and whether it's appropriate and whether it undermines the rights of the accused.
All right, Katie Meyer, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Katie Meyer is State Capitol Bureau Chief and reports for WHYY, among other broadcast media. Coming up, the elections tomorrow and the city of Philadelphia. Billy Penn's Max Maron and the Enquirer's Sean Walsh will be here. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Tomorrow's general election might seem to be a bit low-key for much of the Delaware Valley, but the ballot is busy in Philadelphia. There's the mayor's race and council elections, some of which are competitive, featuring exciting and even unprecedented third-party candidacies. There are ballot questions as well, and a brand-new voting machine makes its debut tomorrow, and not without a little controversy. Lots to cover in this segment of the Roundup, so let's get started as we welcome Max Maron, reporter for Billy Penn. Hi, Max. Welcome back.
Hi, Mary.
And Sean Walsh covers City Hall for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Hello, Sean.
Good morning.
And as always, we're happy to field listener questions and comments. Here's the email address, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. So at the top of the ticket is the mayor's race. And Max, as you write, it's not particularly exciting. It's been a long time since an incumbent was unseated.
It has been. And in Philadelphia, as people around the region might know, the Democratic voter advantage is about 7 to every 1 Republican. So this basically means that in years where we have a municipal election, the primary is the real race. And we have a Republican challenger named Billy Ciangolini. He's a defense attorney from South Philadelphia who is running against Kenny. Unfortunately, he hasn't exactly. There hasn't been too much of a tense campaign. Ciangolini raised only over about $10,000. A race like this requires several hundred thousand dollars to unseat an incumbent. So it hasn't been particularly exciting, but it's, you know, nonetheless, you know, you will see any voters in Philadelphia challenger on the ballot. And you can, yeah, I don't know if there's anything to add to that.
Well, you know, let's get back to Kenny for just a moment. You know, he's likely going to win tomorrow, but, you know, one never knows. But still, an awful lot of Philadelphians do not like his signature achievement, which is the sweetened beverage tax. But they do like the funding that comes from the tax. Can you get into that a bit, Sean?
Sure. That's certainly what the Republicans up and down the ballot are talking a lot about, trying to link candidates to the DA, Larry Krasner, for one. And then the other thing that keeps coming up is, you know, connections to supporting the soda tax. So the soda tax, or the sweetened beverage tax, because it's more than just soda, is unpopular on the face of it, but I don't think there's been quite the level of backlash that opponents of it were hoping for. And it doesn't seem like even on the council campaign trail, the talk of overturning it, you know, through elections, getting more people who are opposed to it, that didn't ever quite materialize. So they're talking about it, but it doesn't seem like it's going to change.
And back to Billy Ciangolini, the Republican. You know, he's knocking Mayor Kenney on hot-button issues, including the sweetened beverage tax. He wants to rescind Philadelphia's sanctuary city policy, if I'm correct. And also is against a supervised injection site. But some of the questions about Ciangolini, there are some opponents who say, well, this guy really leads to the far right. Is there any fact to that, or is there that just kind of stuff that's floating in the air, not necessarily substantiated? What are you hearing, Max?
No, even Republicans within the local party would say that Ciangolini appeals to more of the far right base in the city. And just running against those three signature items, you know, those items I feel are probably representative of the Republican Party as a whole. But in terms of his appeal and some of his dynamics, some of his like theatrics that he does, uses his Facebook page a lot to sort of start, you know, little shouting matches. At one point, he like targeted a South Philadelphia restaurant that had gone after or that had raised money for undocumented immigrants. Those sort of tactics, I think people would liken more to a sort of Trump-styled local Republican.
Jim Kenney has refused to debate Billy Ciangolini. Is that unusual?
Refused to utter his name, really, to acknowledge his existence. Yeah.
What's the method behind the madness there, as he said?
The method is Ciangolini has close to zero name ID among voters now, and having the mayor give him a platform would only help Ciangolini, presumably, and only hurt the mayor, or neither. So it's a common incumbent strategy to almost completely ignore your opponent. I think Kenny is taking it to, you know, the highest level you can and literally not saying his name out loud. Yeah.
And taking a little side route here, aside from tomorrow's election, Sean, you were writing about the fact that Kenny indicated he might have his thoughts elsewhere in 4 years.
He hasn't said that publicly. We've been hearing from a lot of people that, you know, who have talked to him that he is sort of exploring the possibility of running for governor in 2022 or talking to people about how feasible that would be. I got a couple people that have talked to him to tell us that, yes, this is, in fact, something he's talking about. Doesn't mean he will do it, but it is under consideration.
Okay. Let's look at some city council races, the open at-large seats. Two of these are held by law for minority party candidates. And this is where it gets interesting, right, Max? Mm-hmm. They usually go to Republicans. But Working Families Party candidate Kendra Brooks, she's really getting some attention. Tell us about her.
Kendra Brooks is a longtime like education activist and Nicetown native of Philadelphia who's, you know, been around for years and years, has, you know, pretty good name recognition in the community. She joined the Working Families Party earlier this year, which is a party that's only about, you know, 20 years old. It came out of New York, and it's now sort of like galvanizing in Philadelphia. And she is running on the ticket for the at-large seats, those two seats reserved for the minority party, with a running mate in the Working Families Party named Nicholas O'Rourke.
Who's doing pretty well, too, as far as fundraising is concerned, right?
Definitely. Yeah, they've both raised a record-setting amount of money for a third-party candidate running for these seats. Now, people need to keep in mind, these two seats have been held by Republicans since the Philadelphia's charter went into effect in the 1950s. And so it's pretty unprecedented for a candidate to be able to have kind of galvanized the amount of support that they've had. A lot of huge Democratic names, Councilmember Helen Gim, breaking away and offering like an endorsement to this other party. It's created a lot of drama in the local Democratic.
Yes. There might be repercussions, I should say, for Helen Gim. Bob Brady, the Democratic Party chair, not happy with the fact that a Democrat has left the fold, Sean?
Not happy. And the reason for that is, although there are 7 at-large city council members, each voter only gets to vote for 5 candidates, and there are only 5 Democrats on the ballot. So Bob Brady, chairman of the party, wants voters to just pull the lever, straight ticket, Democratic vote. But to vote for one of these Working Families Party candidates, you would have to split your ticket or just pick those two and not vote for any Democrats or vote for a mix of candidates from different parties. So the party apparatus is not happy about this, and they're threatening to, you know, kick out of the party, to expel from the local party any Democratic elected official or ward leader, rather, or committee member who encourages people to vote for non-Democrats.
Well, A, how do they go about doing that? Can they do that? And B, do you think Helen Gim, who's always been really outspoken, would this bother her, do you think?
There is a long history of ward leaders, which are kind of the, you know, the foot soldiers of the party, to breaking away and offering different endorsements. Some have been penalized for this in the past. Some haven't. It's pretty inconsistent history. We will see on this this very strange of election days how much, you know, support. I mean, the logic here is that you need about 40,000 votes to be one of the Republicans. Historically, that's about like the height of how many votes they're going to get citywide for these citywide seats. So it's a lot of people to bring to the polling places and vote for a party that most people have not heard of.
Well, as your sense as observers, do you think this is possible tomorrow? I mean, let's talk about the count of Republican voters in the city as opposed to independent and third party voters. Is that the latter group grown sizably?
It's possible. It seems more possible this year, obviously, than any previous attempt at winning these seats by a third party. But it is uncharted territory. I mean, political predictions are always a fool's errand, but especially this time, this is, you know, a truly novel experiment. So it's difficult to predict.
So the Republicans, David Owen, is it Al Taubenberger? Are they sweating right now?
They're sweating for a couple reasons, because they also have Republican challengers who
correct
are doing well.
Right. There are also 5 Republicans you'll see on the ballot tomorrow. And again, only 2 spots. Mm-hmm. One of them is well backed by some of the building trades unions, which are very politically influential in the city and has a lot of support. And David O and Al Taubenberger have been taking hits over various legislative record issues and other things, other sort of feuds within the Republican Party. So, yeah, they have to, as Sean said, like they have their work cut out for them tomorrow.
So let's get to a couple of other council races. The 10th District, longtime Republican incumbent, Ryan O'Neill, stiff challenge there from a Democrat?
Perhaps. It's the only competitive district-based seat on city council. There are 10 districts. Almost all of them are overwhelmingly Democratic. The 10th District in far northeast Philly is also Democratic, but it is a more competitive district, and it has been held by a Republican for 40 years. Democrat Judy Moore is challenging Ryan O'Neill. She had the backing, initially it seemed, of this outside spending group called Philadelphia 3.0, which has done very well recently. And so that seemed to be giving her a chance. What we're hearing is that 3.0 seems to have backed out of the race or stopped supporting her at some point. People aren't seeing mailers from them or people knocking on their door. So it's unclear how that will play a role.
Okay. And in the 6th District, I believe, the seat that's held by Bobby Heenan, who was under indictment.
Correct.
So do we know if he has a strong challenge in the 6th District, or will Heenan, who says he is, who says he's not guilty in the IBEW Local 98 case, charges of conspiracy, bribery, and fraud, which happened earlier this year, do we know much about his support in the 6th?
Yeah, we reported pretty heavily after the indictment dropped back in February that, you know, the councilman's support in the 6th District, a lot of people were, you know, feeling, you know, apprehensive about it. We still maintain a strong body of support up there. And the most telling sign of that was that he didn't have a Democratic challenger in the primary, which was, you know, politicians generally, the rule of thumb, the conventional wisdom holds that if you have an indictment in your name, you're incredibly vulnerable politically. And for a race like that, it would have been a time for another, you know, Democrat with well-known name recognition to jump in. Now Heenan faces a Republican opponent in his district, you know, in the Northeast Philadelphia. It's not unheard of. Obviously, Brian O'Neill has held that seat for 40 years as a Republican in a Democratic city. But, you know, Heenan still has the backing of the building trades unions. He still has a lot of people. Only one of his colleagues has called on him to resign at this point. So he hasn't been facing a lot of pressure, and that race hasn't really got attracted as much attention for that reason.
Let me reintroduce you. Max Maron is a reporter for Billy Penn.
Hello.
And Sean Walsh is City Hall reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. We have a question from a listener named Mary. She asks, can your guests speak about Sherry Cohen?
Sure.
Sean.
Sherry Cohen is also making a third-party run for these council at large seats. She has creatively named her own party the A Better Council Party, which is wise of her because it moves her up on the ballot position because it's in alphabetical order. It's like AAA plumbers for city council. But so Sherry Cohen is a long-time tenants' rights advocate and lawyer, and ran as a Democrat in the past, including earlier in this cycle, and asked a court to remove her from the primary ballot, which became controversial because there's a state law saying you can't lose in a primary and then run in the general as an independent. But she got a court opinion to side with her and say that because she was removed from the ballot before the election, she is allowed to run as a Better Council's nominee for city council.
Okay, thanks for that question, Mary. Let's get to another race. Philadelphia sheriff, if elected, Rochelle Bilal would become the first black female sheriff in city history, correct?
First elected.
I'm sorry, first elected.
There was one appointed in the past. There was a slight nitpicking. But
okay,
yes.
Thanks for that, Max. She defeated incumbent Jewel Williams in the primary. He was embroiled in a number of sexual harassment scandals / allegations.
Right. Sheriff Williams for years has been facing some of these allegations in the light of the Me Too movement happening nationwide. Several lawsuits have been lodged against him and employment complaints from some of his female subordinates. And in general, his office has faced kind of unprecedented pressure for this sort of older law enforcement agency in the city that doesn't really function like a, you know, like how sheriff's office functions across the country, right? Our sheriff's office is tasked really with just providing law enforcement, being like the law enforcement arm of the court system. And they do a variety of other duties. But, you know, for this race, you know, the big race this year was in May. And Rochelle's unseating of Williams was, like, largely just a huge move.
Sea change for the office.
Exactly.
Is she running unopposed?
Yes. She'll be running unopposed in this election. So, again, that was another one that was sort of decided in May, but a little more firmly than some of the other races.
Okay, so this is the election in which Philly's controversial new voting machine gets its initial run, correct? Tell us more about the Express Vote XL and why it is controversial, Sean.
It's controversial because of a number of reasons. This was a state mandate for all the counties to replace their voting machines that a lot of the counties complained about not receiving funding for. But Philadelphia picked its voting machine when the city commissioners, who are sort of the elected election officials in Philadelphia, picked this company. What is it called? ESNS. In a, some would say, a rushed procurement. They sort of surprised everyone and picked them very quickly. And there are questions now about, you know, how they got selected. Was it a favorable bidding process? Mm. The city controller has audited the process for this. And this is sort of the maiden voyage. So we'll see if any of the problems with the procurement result in functionality.
Yeah, just to add one thing to that, this was rolled out after the, you know, sort of meddling in the 2016 election, and you know, the mandate is to have these machines in effect by 2020. Another one of the controversial aspects of this was that, you know, we still had another year to select to pick the voting machines, and critics said that.
So why rush?
Yeah, the critics would say, why are we rushing this? You know, the city elections officials say we need to have them in place by 2019, tomorrow's election, to give them a test run to really work out the kinks over the next year before the 2020 election. So
speaking of the kinks, there are concerns about whether the new digital touchscreen will enhance security. Have you heard about that?
There are some concerns about this. It's a lot of very technical details that you can be difficult to break down online. But, you know, you will. There's a lot of compatibility issues in general. A lot of people concerned. Some of the critics are concerned about just elder voters. How will the engagement work? This is a very large iPad-looking structure with a lot of, like, touchscreen buttons. They've been testing elections officials and even city elected even elected officials themselves have been, you know, hosting these test runs of the machines, trying to show voters them over the last couple of months to show them how compatible it is. So, you know, we would love to hear your concerns about the machines if you want to send us a message tomorrow.
At where?
tips at billypenn.com.
There you go. Okay. And again, City Controller Rebecca Reinhart is investigating.
She has issued her report, and it was highly critical of the selection process.
Okay. So to wrap us up, there are three questions on the ballot in Philly, one of which we discussed earlier, the statewide Marcy's Law referendum. The other two, should Philly change the threshold for RFPs to give more local businesses a chance? What's an RFP?
We were just talking about one. That is a request for proposal. It's okay. The bidding notice that cities put out when they're going to buy something or hire somebody.
Okay. And should Philly take out another $185 million bond? Do we know what that would go towards, that money?
No, but no bond election in Philadelphia history has ever failed. Do you know, Max?
It's not earmarked okay. on the ballot question.
But. All right. And just quickly back to the mayor's race for just a moment. So the last competitive Republican was who? Sam Katz?
Yeah,
back against, I think, a couple decades ago against John Street. I think they ran twice. There were two different elections. The one, I think, Katz lost by a hair, and I think the margin was bigger than the second one. Mm-hmm. You know, as observers, you've got about 30 seconds left. Why does it seem as if Republicans have not been able to field a competitive candidate in recent decades? Anybody want to hazard a guess?
Well, it's a nationwide trend of cities becoming more blue. But particular to Philadelphia, some would say that the Republican Party kind of gave up and accepted the breadcrumbs of patronage to sort of be in the club. And would you say that's right, Max?
One of the former Republican chairmen said being a Republican in Philadelphia is kind of like being valedictorian of summer school. And that is a reputation that a lot of Republicans have settled into. And some Republicans within and just sort of outside from afar criticize the party for not really vetting and nurturing and grooming some candidates that could be competitive in these races. You know, people say there is room for, Republicans who really primary some people, but, you know, not right now.
All right. We shall see. Tomorrow's Election Day. Max Maron, reporter for Billy Penn. Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks, Mary.
Sean Walsh, City Hall reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And up next, Erica Armstrong Dunbar on her new book, She Came to Slay. It's a biography of Harriet Tubman. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You are listening to the Radio Times Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. This is a significant cultural moment for Harriet Tubman, the first feature-length biopic about the legendary Underground Railroad conductor opened on Friday to huge crowds. There were events this weekend in the Philadelphia area focused on Tubman. There is a movement to place her image on the $20 bill and much more. The woman nicknamed the Moses of her people was born in 1820 and lived a full 91 years. Her achievements were extraordinary and at times have attained an almost mythical status, but there are other very real facets to Harriet Tubman few of us know of. For instance, she was a spy for the Union Army and a fierce advocate for women's rights. Erica Armstrong Dunbar is a National Book Award nominee and author of the new biography, She Came to Slay, The Life and Times of Harriet Tubman. So nice to have you back with us in studio, Erica. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
So the author's note, which opens your book, in that note, you write, paraphrasing, that Tubman is remembered as she should be, as a heroic conductor for the Underground Railroad, but you wanted to present a multidimensional story. There was just a lot about her, some significant achievements, which have received little attention.
Yeah, you know, I wanted readers to really understand Tubman beyond what they see in their high school history textbook, that one page that might be dedicated to her or the pictures that we see of her during Black History Month, and to really be able to think of Tubman not just as a sort of elderly woman, head covered, hands clasped, but to think about her as an enslaved child, as a young woman, a woman, enslaved woman who found love, who married, and to think about her in the Civil War as the first woman to lead a military expedition. And of course, beyond her work with women's suffrage and her work as a social activist for the elderly. And to do all of this as a person who lived with real physical challenges, as really with a disability.
When she was a teen, she suffered a terrible blow to the head. This likely induced a form of epilepsy?
Yeah, we don't have, of course, there was no real medical term for it back then, but she got in the way of a dispute with an overseer who was attempting to reclaim another person, another man, when he asked her to step in and help him sort of tie this person down. She refused, allowing the man to run away. And in his rage, he picked up a 2-pound weight, hurled it at her head, and fractured her skull. And she would live with headaches and basically narcoleptic sleeping spells for the rest of her life.
But they produced visions.
They did. And she talks about this as later on in her life as a sort of as a gift from God. It was definitely something that was a disability, but it was also something that gave her, as she said later on, visions and sort of feelings about the right ways to move while she was on the Underground Railroad, sort of intuition about what was right and what is wrong. And she always credited God for her decisions and the fact that she never lost one person on her during her time on the Underground Railroad. Mm.
We've got a clip from the movie Harriet, in which Leslie Odom Jr., as he plays William Still, an African-American abolitionist, he questions Cynthia Erivo, I believe her name is pronounced, she's playing Harriet Tubman, about the danger of Tubman's work and her abilities. Let's listen.
Rescuing slaves requires skill and careful planning. It requires reading, Harriet. Can you read a sign or a map? Can you read it all?
I put my attention on trying to hear God's voice more clearly.
Do you know what would happen if you got caught? They would torture you until you pointed them right to this office. You got lucky, Harriet. And there's nothing more you can do.
Don't you tell me what I can't do. I made it this far on my own. God was watching, but my feet was my own. Running, bleeding, climbing, nearly drowned. Nothing to eat for days and days, man. I made it. So don't you tell me what I can't do.
Erica Armstrong Dunbar, as you write, Harriet Tubman was only 5 feet tall. Mm-hmm. And again, she could not read or write, but she did have a compass. She knew about the North Star. What made her so tough?
Yeah, you know, I think I'm not certain that any of us really can fathom that level of courage, strength, physical strength. I think that's one of the things we see in the movie that's quite moving, that we understand the physical stamina required to travel over 100 miles from the eastern shore of Maryland to Philadelphia over 13 times. And, you know, I think what I try to say in the book is to remind folks that in many ways, the physicality of slavery, the physicality of the duties that she was required to complete, in many ways prepared her to be the gladiator she probably didn't know she'd be.
Well, let's go back to her time as a child. Mm-hmm. She was, how old was she when she was first lent out by the family which enslaved her to other families to do work?
Yeah, she's only 5 or 6 years old.
Unbelievable.
When she's separated from... I mean, we see it as unbelievable, but it was actually very typical for what was happening on the Eastern Shore in the 1820s and 30s, that there wasn't a need for hundreds and hundreds of enslaved people on these smaller farms. And so in many ways, her life is typical of slavery in rural areas that don't have the mythic large plantations. So at 5 or 6, before she has a set of adult teeth, she is hired out. She sleeps on the floor. She's emptying muskrat traps with her little hands in frigid waters.
She's not clothed properly either.
No, none of them were at this point. They're not clothed properly. They're not fed properly. She doesn't have a bed. She sleeps on the floor. And she's ill constantly. She gets the measles and she's still expected to work. And so in many ways, you know, this is the violence of slavery that we see through Tubman's life, and her childhood represents childhood in slavery.
She had a close family and she was born Araminta Ross.
Correct.
What forces shaped her views on enslavement from what you can see in the research that you did?
Yeah, you know, I think that every enslaved person knew that slavery was wrong and knew that there was a higher power, something above the law. But Araminta understood that, Perhaps it was her visions. Perhaps it was from suspicion or rumors. But she didn't think that something was right with her family. And so she grew older. She hired herself out. Her owner allowed her to do this. She saved money. And she saved money not for clothes or whatever. She paid an attorney to go track the records of her family. And what she finds out is that her mother had been promised her freedom at the age of 45 in a will, and that the family had ignored it. And not only was her mother to receive that, but all of her children were to receive it as well. So Araminta was supposed to be free at 45. I mean, that's a very long time in the antebellum era. That's old age. But still, she knew the family had ignored it and knew that there would be really very little chance for her to ever find her own freedom.
And she watched people she loved being sold to other families.
She did. The three of her sisters were sold to the Deep South, and this was very familiar, a familiar story for enslaved people in the antebellum era, down to the growing new states of Mississippi and Alabama, where cotton production was necessary and required by slave owners. So she lost her three sisters.
How did you become Harriet Tubman?
Yeah. When in 1844, she marries a free black man by the name of John Tubman. And there's some discrepancy with historians about when she actually takes the name Harriet Tubman and leaves behind Araminta Ross. I tend to believe or err on the side of she chose Tubman as a last name when she married her husband, John Tubman. And she took the name Harriet, which was her mother's name. And so we believe that she really did that prior to, this is something slightly different than what we see in the movie, but she does it prior to arriving in Pennsylvania.
So when she was about 27, she makes a solo bid for freedom. It's not her first bid, but it's a solo bid. Tell us about that.
Yeah, she actually sets off in September of 1849. She has a feeling, a premonition, because she had been ill for some time, that she was actually going to be sold. She knew this was her moment. And she, along with two brothers, attempt to run away. And to make a very long story short, her brothers, they chicken out. And they return. And they drag.
There was a lot against them, though.
Oh, they were illiterate. It was cold. It was sort of dealing with the darkness, not being able to read signs or anything. And they decided that it would be better to face punishment at home than the unknown. So they drag Harriet back, and she makes the decision, I can't live this life. And it's sometime after October that she does make this solo run and reaches the border of Pennsylvania on her own.
Most fugitives were men, and for Harriet, the fact that she had no children turned out to be a blessing. Why?
Yeah, I think for those of us who study enslaved women, we know that part of the reason the number of fugitive men is much higher than women is because so many women were tied to their children and did not want to leave a farm or a plantation or home where their children would be left behind. Tubman had no children with John Tubman, and in some ways that, I don't want to say it freed her up, but it let her not have the same kind of feelings of guilt.
And fear.
And fear.
Yeah.
And also gave her, but she did have empathy because a number of the people that she ferried to freedom were women.
She could not turn away a mother with an infant.
She couldn't.
An infant could be a liability.
Of course.
They cry.
Babies cry all the time. There's no way to prevent that, especially when you're cold and hungry and in the woods. And so she actually drugged the babies, and she used.
With what, do we know?
Yeah, we do. There's a form of medication called paregoric, which is an opioid. I remember taking it when I was a child for stomach aches, but in large doses, it would quiet the children. And so she would do that. She would drug the babies, put them in a basket, and carry them north.
Mm. Erica, and we don't have a whole lot, so much to talk about here, but I'm just curious about the research you did into a woman who lived so long ago, and finding the meticulous detail that you presented in the book. What did you look into? Where'd you go for that?
Yeah, in some ways I'm really fortunate that there are a good number of biographies about Tubman that exist. I do believe that I'm the first black woman historian to write a biography of Tubman on a major press. And so, I relied on some of my biographer friends who've written on Tubman, Catherine Clinton, Kate Clifford Larson, but also reading through her own supposed testimony that was written in 1869 by Sarah Bradford. And so reading her words and also sort of asking myself, okay, Erica, what do you bring to Tubman's story that's new? We haven't had a biography of Tubman in over a decade. And I wanted to bring something that was accessible and that was modern and would bring a modern reader to her story, a story that seems long ago and far away. And that's why I titled it She Came to Slay.
But she's fearless.
Yeah.
Yeah. She became a Union spy during the Civil War. I hadn't, you know, the little bit of history I learned, I never knew that. And this is when she was dubbed a Black She Moses by a reporter from the Wisconsin State Journal, as you write. Tell us just a bit. We don't have that much time about her mission on the Combahee River?
Combahee
River, deep into Confederate territory.
Yeah, she's actually asked by, this is in 1862, she's asked by the governor of Massachusetts to go down to be a spy and a scout. And she arrives in South Carolina, and eventually she, after a little bit of time, she figures out who her allies are, and she learns where all of the torpedoes have been planted on the river by the Confederates. And so, and of course, who's telling her this? It's enslaved people, right? Because they're the ones that planted the torpedoes. And so she's able to literally maneuver gunboats, Union gunboats, up the river and to surprise the Confederates while they're sleeping in the early morning hours in June of 1863. And not only does she run off the Confederates, but she, in one fell swoop, she manages to liberate over 700 enslaved people in South Carolina.
Getting them on the boat.
She does. She gets them on there, bringing everything with them that they have, and she brings them to Union lines, to freedom.
And another fact about Tubman, again, that's not widely publicized, is that in her 60s, she began to actively advocate for women's rights and the right to vote.
Yeah, and I'm hoping that we really sort of, that this isn't just a sort of small moment of Tubman. I think as we move into 2020, a year where we celebrate 100 years of suffrage, that Tubman is a part of that story. She forms friendships with women who were well known in the suffrage movement because they were all abolitionists.
Right. But while there were also tensions between white and black.
Indeed.
And then the movement.
She really was one of the few who was able to walk the line, to hold on to her relationships with white women, and to be revered and respected and a part of black women's suffrage movements. And it was a tricky time, a difficult time. And we can argue there's vestiges of that today.
Hmm. Have you had a chance to see the movie,
Harry?
You have? What did you? Does it tell the story as you feel it should?
So, you know, I'm one of those cranky historians, but I will say I think it's a wonderful film and that people should go see it. I'm super impressed that it was written, directed, produced by black women. And I think that's a feat that we have to respect and admire. And hopefully we'll see more people having the opportunity to tell these stories.
As you write, Erica, we don't know how Tubman would have celebrated the 13th Amendment to the Constitution. How do you imagine that she did, which, of course, prohibited slavery?
Oh, I think, you know, the first thing that comes to mind, of course, is she got on her knees and thanked her God. And it was her fierce relationship with God that she always credited to any success that she had. So, you know, she knew the people who were involved in the work of anti-slavery, but it was really her God that ended human bondage.
Is there a story regarding Tubman's trips to free enslaved people that affected you in particular?
Yeah, you know, I think that it was perhaps because I am a mother, that it was the stories of her rescuing children, women with children. And one of her first missions actually wasn't to the Eastern Shore, it was to Baltimore. And it was because she knew that her niece and her children were going to be sold. And she orchestrated the first escape that she would lead. And for me, it's sort of thinking about a woman who gave everything for everyone moves me every time.
Erica Armstrong Dunbar, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Her book is She Came to Slay, The Life and Times of Harriet Tubman. And Erica will be speaking at the Philadelphia Free Library tomorrow night at 7:30. As always, don't forget to check us out on social media. We are at whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers are Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Great to have you along for Radio Times.